to the splendor, the spectacle, the sparkling sensation, where the romance, the comedy, and the thrill of Disney fantasies come to electric life.
And as our friend Jiminy said, welcome. Welcome to the Disney Nerds Podcast, a place each week where like-minded people get together to discuss all things Disney. We'll help you get your Disney fix on. Here we go.
A Magic Kingdom proudly presents, in a million points of musical light, the magical worlds of Disney.
Welcome back to the Disney Nerds Podcast. This is show number 87. I'm Sam from Sam's Disney Diary. With me today is your Disney travel specialist from Once Upon a Time Travel, Jimmy. What's happening, my man?
Man, I am here, and I am very, very ecstatic, excited, and a little bit nervous about this show.
Let's jump right in, and wow, dude, this is incredible. We have the pleasure of spending some time today with the award-winning director, producer, and animator, Jerry Reese. Jerry, how are you?
Good. I'm ecstatic, nervous, all of the above.
So absolutely. And thank you for spending some time with us. Now, before we get started, for those of you listening, trust me here, you are familiar with Jerry's work. Jerry trained at CalArts. He's directed live action, animation, and live CGI films, including Susie's Hope, The Marrying Man, Brave Little Toaster, and Space Jam. In 1982, Jerry was part of computer image choreography for the original Tron. How cool is that? Part of the animation department for Black Cauldron, a character animator for Fox and the Hound, and the list goes on and on. But now here's the cool stuff. Jerry's directed a record 16 multimedia Disney theme park attractions for Florida, Paris, Anaheim, and the Disney Cruise Lines. Now those include Disneyland The First 50 Magical Years, Disney's California Adventure TV special, Sounds Dangerous, Cranium Command, Michael and Mickey, Indiana Jones Stunt Spectacular, Animation Magic, Oh Canada, Tourist from Hell, The Editing Story, and attraction pre-shows that are beloved in the Disney community, including Dinosaur, Extraterrestrial, Alien Encounter, Rock and Roller Coaster, and one of my favorites, Back to Neverland. Wow. Jerry's directed Steve Martin, Robin Williams, Martin Short, Drew Carey, Goldie Hawn, George Lucas, Michael Eisner, and the list just goes on. Most recently, Jerry's been working on the Marvel Experience, a theme park attraction currently touring North America with scheduled stops in Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, and St. Louis. You have seen Jerry's work. Jerry, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for the introduction. That's great. I should take you on the road with me and have all my intros.
Right. I don't know where to start after we leave. After we go through that stuff.
Yeah,
start wherever you want. You should have a hat, a bunch of just notes in the hat. Stir them around and pick one out.
Well, you start with CalArts. How can you not start there? Some of the you were there at a point in time when it was just starting, right? And there was so much happening in the studio at that point in time.
Had to be incredible. Talent.
That's true, and I actually started before CalArts, actually, and then was CalArts. So I was, as a teenager, and I was still in high school, I went to a local audiovisual at a medical center, and it was the only place I could find that would hole-punch animation paper. So I'd order the Acme paper, and then I wanted to get the hole-punch properly done. So I snuck in there, and somebody saw me, and wondered what this kid was doing there. And first was kind of, upset. And then I explained that I was doing animation and I appreciated if they would let me use their hole punch a little bit. So he wanted to see what I was doing. And I brought an example in the next time I came in. So anyway, his attitude really changed. He really was impressed that a kid was doing some decent animation. And he said, you did this? You didn't trace it? And I said, yeah. So he tore off a piece of paper and wrote a phone number on it. And the phone number was to the production manager of the Disney Feature Animation Department, Ed Hansen. And he said, if you're interested, I heard this rumor that Disney's going to start looking for young people because their veterans are getting close to retirement. And so if you're interested, here's a number. So I called the number and talked to Ed Hansen, and my dad drove me down, and I was just astounded that I was given a desk next to Eric Larson, who was one of Disney's famous nine old men. Actually, Eric was still very active. Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson were still at the desk animating. Milt Call was still at the desk animating. Mark Davis was running in and out and doing all kinds of interesting things. So it was this just dream come true for me. And so during the last couple of years of high school, I would pop in and do visits to the studio, and I had my assigned desk, and I would do tests, and Eric would mentor me. And so as I got close to graduating, they said, well, we're going to start this new program out at CalArts. It's called the Character Animation Program. How would you like to be teacher's assistant for that? So I said, yes, please. So I basically lived at the feature animation department for the summer prior to that first year of CalArts. And so I was preparing materials. I was just amazed I could go through the morgue, they called it. It's not what it sounds like, but at the studio, they called the archive the morgue. It's like, hey, you want to check a scene out from the morgue? So I could go through and go, oh my gosh, this scene from Pinocchio was great. It would be wonderful if the students had that as a flipping scene, as an example. So I could just order scenes. They'd bring the original drawings in between cardboard, and I could flip through and pick out a series of drawings, and they did really careful copies. They had a Xerox department where the Xerox machine took up three rooms, and it had a big lens in one room, and the drawing was sucked up against a vertical plane, and then they would take a picture and go through the middle room, and then it would be printed out in the third room. So they did these careful copies of these flipping scenes. And so I had the joy of finding things that I thought were exciting, and I thought that my fellow classmates would find exciting. And part of the process was making out exposure sheets. You know, when it goes to the camera department, you have to show how many frames each drawing is exposed, et cetera, et cetera. And so I tried to do careful reproductions of all of that. I felt like almost like a monk doing illuminated text, where I would get all the different properly colored pencils out. And they would do like voice modulation, where now you see it on your computer just all the time. Back then, they actually did it by hand to indicate where the voice got loud and soft. And so I was even doing cupping, that kind of stuff. So I was preparing all that stuff to go out there to CalArts. One of the things I was doing was answering the phone for our teacher, Jack Hanna. And so I was taking messages and going, okay, Lasseter, how do you spell that in that last name? Is it two S's? Brad Bird, it's like YRD or IRD? Is this like the flying kind? And then John Musker and Doug Loeffler and Joe Land Cicero, who's, all these people have amazing talent and amazing history. But we had the joy of bumping into each other for the very first time back then in the first year of CalArts. So I was teacher's assistant for the inaugural year. And at the end of that year, like 12 of us were guinea pigs, and they took a look and decided that it was worth keeping the program going. And so we went from there. So for me, it started before CalArts and then really bloomed at CalArts. And after 2 years, they came to us and asked four of us to be college dropouts and jump directly into the feature animation department and start working full time. So not that it set a great example for our kids, but I was one of them, Brad Bird, Doug Loeffler, and John Musker. We were the first four that Disney pulled out of CalArts into the studio. And so we just started full speed ahead. They were just finishing Pete's Dragon. And we just dug in and went from there.
So was that Black Cauldron time? Or what was the first thing that worked on?
It was before Black Cauldron. I came in and helped. There was a real push for the finish line on Pete's Dragon.
Okay.
And they desperately needed cleanup artists. So, they decided that my drawing skills were such that I could jump into that. So I did cleanup on Pete's Dragon. And then between features, we did the small one, Christmas special. And then the Fox and the Hound came up next. And one of the things I experimented with, we were just tiptoeing into the Fox and the Hound, was I was out by the Disney commissary, and I saw these birds, and I knew that we were going to have some animated birds in the Fox and the Hound. And this little sparrow, it was hopping around, and like every second, it would have several really distinct, clear poses. And, you know, we'd always been taught in animation that you can't do that. It's you have to do very direct movement into a pose, hold the pose, make it clear. And I thought, well, yeah, that generally that's true. But this real bird is just has frantic movement in a way, but it's never confusing. It's always completely readable and clear. Like, how the heck is that happening? So I started doing some tests with that. Doing really odd timings, trying to copy them. I looked at live action footage. And the odd thing was I started discovering techniques that really worked, and the directors and my fellow animators looked at it and really got a kick out of it and wanted to follow suit. They wanted to do that kind of style for the characters. But I was employing a bunch of techniques that at the time they said shouldn't be in a feature, at least the going wisdom. So there were things like multiple images where suddenly it would go from sitting still and then in the very next frame leaning a little bit forward and then suddenly looking like it had 10 wings, like an explosion of feathers, and then would just become a streak of color. So I didn't even draw it on model, quote unquote, at all. It just became a color wash for a frame. So those kind of things, Eric Larson, he got really excited about seeing that kind of exploration going on. So he had me do a show and tell for the rest of the animators. And kind of the basic premise was we've all come here and we need to match one another in order to do a film together, of course. But the big joys in life are the differences between us. So as soon as we find a sort of a common ground to match, now we have to accent how one character is completely different from another character so that its personality pops out. And I was showing how, as opposed to the fox, the tiny bird or the big bird would all have different kinds of movement. And I actually showed some live action frame by frame. So I said, okay, there's this sort of understanding we have about what is too cartoony for a feature. And watch this real bird in nature is going to be too cartoony. And so I went frame by frame from one of the nature films they pulled, and people just had this revelation, like, oh my gosh, in the right context, it's not cartoony at all. It just expresses what you feel when you see that thing in nature. So anyway, that was a really fun sort of step forward into experimentation, and all of the veterans there pushed us toward that. They kept saying, we know you like to go look at our scenes from the features and we're flattered that you like them, but we weren't copying other people. We were looking at life. We were looking around us and bringing observations onto the screen, and you guys have to do the same thing. So they were very encouraging.
So is that bird in Fox and the Hound?
Yeah, Dinky and Boomer are the two little birds. So it was funny too. There were two people that worked with me, Rebecca Reese, who's now although her name wasn't Reese at the time, we hadn't gotten married yet. She came through Art Center into Disney, and Sue Croyer at the time. They were doing assistant work and cleanup for me as I was animating, and what they discovered was that as they went through the various departments to get approvals, that even though Eric Larson loved the work that I was doing and the directors liked it when they saw it in movement and all of that good stuff, when they would look at single drawings and they saw the wild caricature, they would go, oh no, you can't have this drawing. They would sit, so they would start to, so Rebecca and Sue, bless their hearts, I started to find out that they told me, they said, by the way, just, you know, we're trying to protect your work because we know everybody likes the way it works in movement, but we have to hide your drawings in order to get them approved. So they would go through my scene and look at any odd special frames and remove them. And then they would go flip the scene and let everybody up the line, the supervisors, take a look, and it would get an approval. And then they would go reinsert the crazy drawings back in, and it would go through ink and paint and camera. And when they saw it in movement, they loved it. So it was just kind of odd that we had to sneak things through that they loved. But, you know, when they dissected it frame by frame, they were still sort of freaked out by the technique that was being used. But then Brad Bird also animated the Dinky character, Cliff Nordberg, John Musker. There were a few other people who jumped in, and they looked at how I was doing it, and they did a similar method to get the timing and the activity. So we got pretty close. I mean, it's still at least it went toward that feeling that you get from nature, where it's is very lively and it has the nervous energy of multiple poses, sometimes several in a second, but is still very readable and feels natural.
I'm going to have to go back and watch the movie now.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. So how do you go from feature animation to theme park attractions? What was that journey?
Aha. Well, it was a journey of actually sort of passion and accident and luck and not by any means a plan. And I had just done a number of things. I'd worked on Tron. Brad Bird and I had gone up and had spent 5 years trying to get the Spirit, Will Eisner's The Spirit, off the ground as a feature. I then had gone and directed The Brave Little Toaster. And so I was just I had done a number of things, really experimenting. And as I came back through and reconnected with the studio, a friend of mine just called, Mark Kirkland, who's, my gosh, he's directed so many Simpsons episodes since then. But he was line producing a project for Disney, and it was the brand new park that was opening, the Disney MGM Studios. And in the animation building, they wanted two things. One is a functioning animation studio where people could look through the glass and see it working. And the second thing was a preamble movie and sort of a tour guide segments through this tour, so that you could understand the process of Disney animation, what made it special. And so, unbeknownst to me, that had been about 10 months work in progress. Mark was the line producer on it. And he just called me up one day, and it was not a job offer by any means. He just said, you know, I like your sense of storytelling. And, you know, we've got a couple things in development. We've even had Frank and Ollie come over and look at it. But, you know, 10 months in, it doesn't feel like the energy's picking up. If anything, it feels kind of like the wind is going out of the sails a bit. And, you know, this is about Disney feature animation, and that's where you started. So, you know, just would like to get your two cents. So I went in just to do that. There was a storyline with Carol Burnett and Donald Duck going through an animation studio. There was a Siskel and Ebert, which were two critics of the time, segment where they were sitting in a theater and they would have giant cells and they would talk about how many frames a second, etc. So they went through some, you know, elaborate concept art and storyboards and all this good stuff. And there were people like Steve Moore working on it, Tom Enriquez, some wonderful people that had been hired onto it. But after seeing the presentation, I just said, well, frankly, neither one of these is about what makes Disney animation special. I mean, the bragging rights you're talking about are the same as any studio. You know, the number of frames a second doesn't make it special. And sure, the fact that it's painted on the back of a cell, like, that stuff isn't what makes Disney special. And they were like, well, what makes Disney special? And I said, well, you know, it's the fact that every department is the story department. You don't pick a color because it's pretty. You pick a color because of what it says emotionally about the character at that moment in time and the story. And a prop, a costume, everything is being picked because of its story value, its emotional value at that very moment. And so I said, instead of getting analytical people to dissect statistics, you know, it'd be fun to get somebody really emotional to celebrate the fact that it's all about emotion and connecting with you. And in fact, I had just recently put a phrase together. I'd been arguing with another producer about what animators should do, and he loved rotoscope and just thought that animators should trace and make things move. And what I told him was, I feel like it's not how you move the drawings, it's how the drawings move the audience. So it's the emotional connection that sure. matters. So I kind of wrote that down. It's like, it's not how you move the drawings, it's how the drawings move the audience. And put that up as a slogan. And I said, you know, to me, if you had somebody feeling that, you know, you want them to show their joy and excitement and fear and all those other things at going through this experience of seeing how Disney creates emotion. So instead of casting people like Siskel and Ebert or Carol Burnett, as wonderful as she is, maybe somebody like Robin Williams, and just let him be a kid in a candy store and be able to invent and create. And so anyway, that was just my two cents. And so they said, well, hold on a second. And the head of the studio, Bob Rogers and Company, he really had, he was very brave. He called and talked to, I believe it was Peter Schneider, I think was who he talked to. But he said, you know, the last 10 months of work or so, I think I think we're going to unplug that. And it's like, what? Sort of screaming on the other end of the phone. He says, well, you know, Jerry Reese came in, and it's like, you know, Peter Schneider didn't know who the heck I was. So that didn't make any difference to him. So there's more yelling on the phone.
So Carol and Donald are gone, and Siskel and Ebert are gone, and you need somebody with
lots of
energy.
And the whole story has changed. Like, the whole thing you're telling is different, and have somebody that has a lot of emotional energy and shows their emotion, carries it on their sleeve in just a joyous, immediate way, seemed like the better casting notion. So anyway, he then tells me, okay, you've got like 4 weeks to get a presentation ready for Schneider.
That's what I was wondering. How far before opening did they pull this plug? Because this has to be open for the opening of the park, right?
Right. And then said, and if Peter says yes, then you've got another 2 weeks or 3 weeks to get it ready for Katzenberg. And I went, but my question was, well, what are you talking about? I came here to give you an opinion today. And they went, oh, no, you're directing it. So that shock where I had no plans, I wasn't going in for a job interview at all. And they just saw the passion that I brought to it from my experience learning under the wonderful veterans at Disney. And like so many of my classmates who all took it under their wing to make sure that the veterans' message got out there, I just felt that same impulse. Like, we can't let their message die. We got to keep the message clear and strong and going out to the audience so they know, you know, what drives Disney Animation. So they just, I got on my soapbox, did my speech, and they went, you're directing it. So it was a total, total shock. And then the next impediment was Katzenberg was a little afraid of the idea of using Robin Williams in something that was related to Disney Animation. You know, he was doing Good Morning Vietnam, but that was like an adult movie. And he said, you know, it's a different thing with animation. It's family friendly, and you're casting somebody who's in a crotch grabbing adult comic. And so I reminded him, I said, well, okay, Pinocchio. Do you think of Pinocchio as a charming, safe, but wonderful Disney movie? Oh, yes. So I said, well, you know, Jiminy Cricket was voiced by Cliff Edwards, whose stage persona was Ukulele Ike. He entertained mom and dad when they got a babysitter and they went out in the evening. He worked blue, and also he had substance issues, and Walt cast him, and he is a classic character. So I said, I really feel like it's kind of making a Walt kind of choice, because back in the day, he was a contemporary figure to those people, and in the same way that Robin is now. And he was edgier than he was in Pinocchio. Walt reined him in and had him do family material for that.
Sure.
So anyway, they said, well, okay, since it's a short film, this can be sort of the test, but we'd never do this for a feature, but we'll let you experiment for this short. And then thankfully, you know, we had a wonderful time working together, and just it was pell mell to get the whole thing. You know, we just started pinning up new index cards and storyboards, and did temp tracks for everything so people could sort of see how it might play, and then brought Robin Walter in. And at first I recorded Robin's voice so we could get the animators at work, and then brought Robin and Walter Cronkite to the set so they could be filmed together. And so I was juggling the live action and the animation teams at the same time, and we fortunately finished together, opened, the public had a really good time, and immediately John Musker and Ron Clemens, in looking at our film, where it was not only Robin, but Robin improvising and morphing, went, hey.
So that was going to be one of my questions. How much do you direct Robin, or just point him in a direction and boof, back to Neverland? Here we go.
It's actually, he's very respectful of material. And it's funny because I'm sure you guys are aware of the wonderful voice actor Corey Burton. Who's done a ton of voices for Disney over the years, including, you know, Paul Frees sound alike when they need the Haunted Mansion voice, and all kinds of amazing things. Well, he came in and did temp voice for Robin, for my story reels. He also did Cronkite temp voice as well. And so I shaped it and built it, and I tried to write in the manner of what Robin might do. But knowing, of course, that I would want to hire him because you want his brain to go to work. You don't want to put handcuffs on him.
Absolutely.
But when I first was recording with him, I played that back so he got to hear somebody sounding like him, sort of being entertaining. But I apologized ahead of time and said, look, you know, I had to put something in front of the teams that are approving this so they get an idea. And now I really want you to play. So he's like, oh, I hope I can play a little bit. And it's like, yes, you can. So I said, well, all I need is for you to set up at the end of this improv, and I invite you to play. And at the end of it, you have to hit this line to set up Walter for his next gig, you know. So he's like, okay, cool. And then I went to the next one and said, here's another area where you can play, and here's another area where you can play. And as I was going through, he's like, oh, well, I don't want to change everything. You know, there's some good writing here. So he was just very respectful and accommodating. So he, you know, so he wanted to meet halfway, and there was one of the biggest laughs, you know, everybody, I'm a corporate symbol, where he turns into Mickey. Sure. That actually was a line, an idea and a line that was storyboarded by Steve Moore. And he was on my storyboard team, and it just busted me up. It busted all of us up. When I was first giving Robin the show and tell of the storyboards, he did a big belly laugh, and his agent and manager and Eisner and Katzberg, the whole parade that was standing behind us while I was showing him the boards, they really turned and paid attention. It's like, what made Robin laugh? And it was that joke. And I think that's probably the only reason it got left in. I kept waiting for Katzberg to go, all right, Jer, pull that out. We're not going to make fun of the studio. But they left it in. So he did a combination of really playing with things, but shaping them so he could set Walter up for his next lines. And then occasionally sprinkling in things where he just went, you know, I'll improv around it, but this is good. Boom, he would put it in. And then something else that really startled me in a good way is I had no idea how adept he was at molding his own improvisation. So, you know, he'd want to discuss beforehand, like, you know, what are some of the things I'd be referring to? What kind of films were going on then? And so we would just sit there and brainstorm. It could be this one, that one, that one, that one. Okay, good. So he would just want to sort of load his mental Cuisinart, you know, before he spun it up. And then something would come out, and I could call cut at the end and say, that was great, but, you know, the thing you hit in the middle, that was so funny. Can you move that to the end so it's the button? And he'd go, okay, cool, let's go again, you know, and he'd just record, and boom, he'd move it to the end. And I just was astounded. It sounded just as fresh, but he reshaped it so it just sounded like the first time he ever said it, and he would move things. So anyway, I was amazed. And Rebecca told me that when, you know, she was on the story team for Aladdin, and she said she remembers when John and Ron came in and went, you know, we were really thinking about him for the genie after seeing the film. And what was it like for Jerry to work with him? I mean, was he a loose cannon? Was he a nice guy? What was it? And she said, oh, you know, he had a wonderful time working with Robin, but talk to him. So, you know, we chatted about it, and they had an equally fun time. And I envied them having the length of an entire feature to craft a story with him. And I just love going to see it.
That's fantastic. And I want to point all of our listeners to, if you have never seen Back to Neverland, please take the time and go. I've watched it a couple times, and you can find, they're not great, but you can find it on YouTube.
Little bootlegs.
Yeah, little bootlegs. Yeah.
Little bootlegs. Yeah. The thing that always struck me about Back to Neverland was the balance between Robin and Walter.
Yes.
There seemed to be so much balance. Robin would be all over the map, all right, let's straighten out opposite, here.
Yeah.
Let's,
yeah.
And it worked so good.
I was just going to mention that, Robin and Walter, you know, I pitched to Robin when Walter was
had
on
the... Had they worked together before
no,
that?
They,
do you know if they
no,
worked?
They hadn't. So when I pitched it to Robin, he was very intrigued by working with Walter. And man, I mean, Robin got on a soapbox and was telling me how important Walter Cronkite was to American history. And he was going through all these moments in time and quotes and all of that, and had so much respect for Walter. And then I went out and pitched Cronkite on the East Coast, and I took him through a storyboard book and showed him how I was planning on staging him with Robin. And he just was chuckling, and he just said, you know, be very interested to meet this man, you know, and sort of seemed just immediately amused at the idea of being able to work with Robin. He seemed sort of excited about the idea. And then when they got together, man, there were times where I wish I'd had a recording of what was going on behind the scenes. There were a couple times where they had to wait off stage, and then when I call action, they would come out like from behind the giant books into a scene. And we weren't using special effects where it was like CG books. I mean, we built giant books. Right. And so they had to wait tucked in between in a little cave before they came out. And I would just hear in the distance, like, here, and then, and so they would just be laughing and carrying on. You could tell they were joking with each other and having a good old time. And I always wondered what they were talking about. And then later I went to record a few more lines with Robin in New York when he was doing the play Waiting for Godot with Steve Martin. And he told me at that time that he had struck up this real friendship with the Cronkites, and that he and Marcia would go have dinner with them. And so it really was a bond that the two of them had.
That's so fantastic.
Oh, and by the way, just a little piece of trivia for the people, because a lot of people have assumed that Back to Neverland was made after Aladdin because of Aladdin. And it was the inverse. And so that one little piece of evidence that is just so fun, and John and Ron put it in as a purposeful little secret code, is when you see the beginning of Back to Neverland, and Cronkite calls a volunteer out of the crowd, Robin Williams steps up with a goofy hat and a Hawaiian shirt and a camera around his neck, and you know, he just has a very distinctive look. And in live action, that's how Robin looks. When he's taken into animation, he transforms into one of the little lost boys. Well, in Aladdin, you know, John and Ron invited me to the premiere, and they said, we put a permanent tip of the hat to the short just because it got us thinking about Robin. And so it never would have been this kind of movie without that leading the way. So we put a permanent little thank you in the film. Look for it. So I started watching the film, and of course, I just got caught up in the story and stopped looking for it. And suddenly near the end, when the genie gets his freedom and he comes back from one of his time travels, he's wearing exactly the same outfit.
That's awesome.
That Robin wore in the film. It was like, oh, there it is. And they even put out a plush toy with that and some toys. And I think most people that get those toys where it's Genie wearing the Hawaiian outfit, they don't realize that is actually
a shout out
message from John and Ron to me and my team. That's just kind of a little code thing.
You know, something else that's very incredible. Cool is that in the beginning of back to Neverland when Robin's wearing that getup. That's exactly what Sam looks like in the parks.
Oh, yeah? You do your walk around?
It's pretty
stuff?
Darn close, yeah. It's pretty close.
That's funny. I love the fact that you do walk.
That's good. So Back to Neverland was the movie that told the story of animation, and then after that you went into the animation courtyard and the animators were back behind the glass and you could see what was happening in process, right?
Right. And there was a fun little thing. Recently I got contacted by someone who had seen Back to Neverland very soon after it opened. And so I asked him if he remembered seeing the storyboard artist in that first space. It was before there was a whole team of animators yet, but there were storyboard artists in there. And they said, yeah, I remember that. And I said, well, if you go back and look at your storyboards, that it's a very particular, unusual thing that we did. Those storyboard artists were my team storyboarding Cranium Command, which we were going to open later. So you saw Buzzy and Right Brain, Left Brain, and the Hypothalamus, all those characters coming alive on storyboards for the very first time. And so if anybody goes back and looks at their photographs or videos from that era in those early days, they're bound to find some little nuggets of behind the scenes that they don't usually see. People don't usually see the theme park attractions being worked on, but...
That's really cool.
Put them on display. And the reason I did that was they had asked me to work on, to take on Cranium Command and a makeover of the story for the stunt show, the Indiana Jones Stunt Spectacular. So since I had to be basically living in the park dealing with Glenn Randall, the wonderful stunt coordinator who had worked with Spielberg on in the Indiana Jones movies, he was there and his whole stunt team. So I was in the park working with them. And so I had to keep my storyboard artists on the property as well. So I just went, well, you know, let's give people something to look at. And the storyboard pit, that's where you'll be. And so I would run back and forth between the stunt show and the Cranium Command storyboards. And
that's right, because you worked on Indy Jones as well.
Yeah, and it was literally at the same time. So,
wow.
So it was spread pretty thin.
I think that was such a fantastic time. I remember, I mean, I was a teenager going to the studios and being able to see the animators back there working, maybe on Cranium Command. But, you know, that was such a cool time for the studios. It's going to be – it's a little sad that it's – I mean, I keep moving forward, you know, and we want to see things progress. But it was a really cool time for the studios.
It was.
And Cranium Command becomes Inside Out.
That's
awesome.
That's true. And Pete was, one of our young animators on the pre-show. And so the pre-show had animation. Oh. The main show was mostly live action and animatronics and a little bit of animation. But yeah, Pete was there working on the pre-show, and definitely it was a seed.
I gotta
really
look
fun.
For Easter eggs there. When Inside Out comes on, I'm looking for Easter eggs.
And again, let me point the listeners, if you have not seen Cranium Command, be sure to go YouTube. I actually saw one. I actually watched it today. There's a very, very good video of Cranium Command. I don't know how the guy did it, but he had a solo show, so he was the only one in the theater.
Wow!
You can hear a little bit him talking with the cast member, and you can hear him telling her, "Look, I heard it's going to close at the end of this year, so I wanted to get it, you know."
Right.
And then you hear the message with no videotaping or. But he videotaped the whole thing. And, you know, I think it's important some of those things get. I know they don't want you to videotape them. But you know what? I think it's important that we have those things on YouTube to go back and look at, because it's really, really cool.
Well, I know people really share those memories together. And, you know, it's a big part of the whole park experience is sharing it with your friends
it
and
is.
Family. And when something is gone, to be able to still have a way to share it. And, you know, I think
it's a big deal.
Cool.
Yep.
I wish there was an official way that I could get it from you, because that's how I would
well,
do
you know
it.
What?
But it's, without that process.
But it was so – it's so hard to – for something that's so dimensional like that, because we had, you know, two audio animatronic characters in the room. We had Reach Out and Touch You effects going, you know, through the audience, plus the different screens and everything. It's hard to convey that cleanly, and, you know, Disney, you know, just – made it for the lived-in experience rather than doing a movie of that. But it's very cool that somebody went to the trouble to sort of archive it for the rest of us. That's neat.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, I'll shift gears a little bit. Disneyland, the first 50 years. I can't believe that's 10 years ago already.
Isn't that weird?
It's crazy. But the thing that, obviously, Steve Martin is a big part of this one. And this one, in fact, you can get on some of the Disneyland DVDs that are
out. Oh, that's cool.
Steve started in the Magic Shop. That's one of the on Main Street in Disneyland. That's one of the big themes there.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about working with Steve, or just pulling together a history of Disneyland? There was so much clips of Walt and just the incredible history. How difficult was it to pull all of that together?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a challenge. It was a joy. And just a combination of every possible thing you can imagine. I mean, one of the joys was working with Steve, obviously, and having the story he told be true. So he didn't just sort of idealize it. In chatting with him, he verified everything. And but the frustration was that not to have a long enough film where we could go deeper into it, because not only with his stories, but with just an amazing archive of footage. I was lucky enough to be looking at full color footage of the rehearsal the day before Disney opened, like 35 millimeter color film of Bess Parker and kids, and just extraordinary stuff. And I'm like, this has to be in our movie.
Right. Wow.
And but there were time restrictions and important legal things. And, sometimes there'd be cast members in the background or whatever, where they'd say, look, we need to get family clearance from this person, and we don't even know who that is, and so it would take quite a bit of time to go through that. So it was just like being a kid in a candy store and going, and you can take out a gift basket of some of the candies, but there's a ton back here. It would be just great to let people have more access to the richness of what's there. But it was such a treat to be able to give a flavor of that to the audience, and to have Steve kind of relive an important part of his history, of his past. And one of the things he related, and it's just briefly referred to in the film, and I'm glad we got it in, but Steve was really so appreciative of Wally Bogue, who Steve attributes Wally with giving him his start in show business, really. And he told me the story. He said, I worked at the Magic Shop. I would, on breaks, I started looking around the park, and I went past this building, the Golden Horseshoe Review, and I just heard this audience laughing. And so I looked in the window, and I saw this guy on stage, just had him in the palm of his hand. He was like this vaudevillian, just genius performer. It's so adept at timing and setting gags up and paying them off. And so he's like, oh, break's over, run back to the Magic Shop. And then as much as he could, he'd find his way out there and find out Wally's schedule when he was going to be on stage. And then he said pretty soon Wally's looking off the stage going, excuse me, I keep seeing you work here. Your name tag says Steve. What's the deal? And he's like, oh, I think you're amazing, sir. And, I want to see every show. So Wally took him under his wing, and he said, look, learning the banjo, the balloon twist, the arrow through the head. He said so many things that I went out with were things that Wally taught me. And he said, I he launched my career right here at That's Disneyland. Awesome. So it was so fun. The producers arranged for Wally, who thank goodness was still with us 10 years ago, to come surprise Steve. So they had lunch together on the studio lot.
Oh, cool.
And that was just a fun thing. But it was interesting, in the look of the film, Steve is walking through Disneyland on Main Street at Magic Hour. And I just love the look of the Disney parks at Magic Hour. But there's sort of two problems with that. One is that Magic Hour is actually a few minutes and not hours. And the second thing is, you've got all these wonderful visitors at the park who shouldn't be interrupted from walking and doing their thing, or the people later that are getting things ready to play the next day. So we just found it logistically impossible to shoot there. So we did a really careful reproduction of a portion of Main Street in a soundstage, and shot Main Street not on Main Street. And so we were able to get sort of capture the magic hour look eternally. So it always looked in its most magical, and not in get in people's way, and you know, pull the whole thing together.
I want to just take a second just to point our listeners out to your website, www.jerryreese.com, JerryReese. And you've just got some great photos. I'm looking while you're talking about it, I'm just flipping, you know, scrolling through the photos that you've got on your website of you and Steve. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, and got to meet Art Linkletter and stuff. And you know, something that was a real challenge of the project is, you know, Steve has done everything. He's a consummate writer, director, performer, producer, playwright, just on and on. He just has done it all. And the ambition of our shoot plus the schedule limitations, actually the person who had met him in on the East Coast where he was, Steve told him, this is impossible. He just read through and went, well, it's impossible. And so he said, oh, Jerry's used to this stuff. He can do it. So he came back and told me that he had promised that I could do something that Steve Martin said was impossible. Then you got to let me prep the heck out of this thing and really get prepared for him. And one of the things that was going to happen was he gets doused by the elephant in the Jungle Cruise. So he's like, you know, I have to get to this charity event that evening, and I can't stay late. And they're like, oh, don't worry, Jerry will get it in one take. So I told him, okay, guys, we've got to deliver on that. So the physical effects guys, all the departments, really worked like crazy to prep everything. So they were doing tests in the parking lots, and it was a challenge because we had to get the water to arc but come underneath the canopy so it wouldn't splash but be high enough to hit him in the face, and just all these requirements that we had.
So you had to change the attraction to get this to work.
So we had to have our own water jet device that it would exactly right, you know, hit Steve Martin, who needed to have it happen in one take to make that happen and to get like a great shot without a take two and get him to his charity event on time that evening, which he had committed to. And it was a big thing. So, but anyway, there was a lot of pressure on, everybody prepped the heck out of it. We went through our day miraculously. We're keeping on schedule and it came time for that. So the picture where I'm together with him on the boat was just before we did the water. I'm like, okay, Steve, I know you're going to run as soon as you're wet. So let's get a photo real quick. Great, click. And then I called action. He drove the boat. We did the big splash where the elephant gets him. It thankfully hit exactly the way I hoped it would. And thanks to our wonderful physical effects guys and them doing it 1,000 times before that moment. And you know, he ran out to make his event. And I heard back later from Dick Cook's office that Steve had gotten back in touch and went, you know, that was fun. So I was glad his opinion.
We should have done it twice. What?
So I was glad his opinion changed from this is impossible to that was fun. So
that's cool.
That's great.
All right. I'm going to shift a little bit here because this is a question in the back of my mind, right? If I go back to 1982.
Right.
You're a computer image choreographer.
Right.
Right. So for the original Tron, and really you're inventing things as they go and changing and reshaping motion pictures. That's the way that I look at it. So
right.
Working on Tron, I can only imagine in 1982 the type of hardware and software that you were dealing with to come up with these concepts and these ideas. And they're really easy to draw, but then to convert that into computer animation, what was that process like?
It was so intriguing. And Bill Croyer reminded me when we had the 30th anniversary, and we were chatting with some wonderful fans that had come out to the Chinese theater, that I was the only feature animator who jumped onto the project. He sort of did this preamble to the crowd and was like, you know, so Lisberger and we were developing this idea of if we finally found a home at Disney, we go over there and we set up and we put out a call. Who wants to join us? And he said, you know what? One guy out of the whole studio. So some of my friends were going, what are you doing? This is like our enemy and it'll never be as good as us. And or it's push button art. And I went, no, man, this is our tool. And we, you know, who knows what it'll do. We have to make it, turn it into that. And I heard Lisberger talking at that same event, and he said something that was pretty genius. And I went, you know what, you know, kudos to him for having this on his mind. He said at the time that there was a lot of that going on, the different opinions about computers, what they would even lead to, whether they would be dangerous, whether they'd be friendly. And he said, you know what, if we just let it happen, who knows where it'll go. But if I hire a bunch of artists and the artists help shape what computers do, then maybe that'll take the whole industry in a good direction. So it was like film as a subversive act for good. How's that?
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was pretty great that Stephen had that attitude. And so, yeah, we all just every day rolled up our sleeves and would be trying to get stuff to work. You know, Bill and I would storyboard out what we wanted things to look like when they were done, and then do all kinds of diagrams. And I've got some of that stuff on my website in the Tron section, where you see pages and pages of like you'd have to figure out, okay, what's the down shot of this location? What's the floor plan and elevation, and what angle is the camera flying at? And when it turns over a number of seconds, how many degrees does it turn? And what's the sort of organic curve for its motion? And so we just drew, you know, figured all that stuff out and drew it on paper with all these diagrams and charts. And then the wonderful people at III and Magi that were working with us, the various vendors, computer vendors, you know, this was all new for them too. They're like, what? It's,
yeah, they had to be writing the software as you were going, I would
think. Yeah, so we have moments where you'd go, okay, there's supposed to be light around this character, and it's spilling onto him. And they go, well, we can't do that. It's like, well, can you put it behind the colors? Well, then it's opaque. The color's opaque, so he'll disappear. Well, okay, can we put him in front but write an algorithm so that the more his surface curves away from us and is not perpendicular to the camera ray, it gets more and more transparent so the color shows through and it seems like it's lighting them. Oh, we'll try that, you know? And then we'd look at it and go, hey, you know, that kind of, the illusion kind of works. Let's do that. And boom, we'd get another scene done. So it was just kind of flying by the seat of the pants, and with just some go-getter people and all different levels of programming and hardware and software, and wanting to play storyteller with us. And and you know, we had the patience to understand what they were dealing with too, and just something that made sense suddenly to me when I jumped onto Tron. And I hadn't really thought about it until that moment, but years earlier when I was in high school, you know, I'd had mainly creative interests where I was doing creative writing and fine art and animation and music. I was in a number of bands, actually did some studio sessions where I made a little bit of money, and playing electric bass and five-string banjo. And so there was all that kind of stuff that you'd assume, well, sure, you're doing creative things. But then I took advanced math as an elective in my senior year of high school, and my friends were like, why are you doing that? That doesn't fit with anything else you're doing. But I was intrigued, and I wound up going to the medical university nearby. There were only two of us from the high school who were allowed into a computer programming class that the med students were taking. And so in the day, I mean, it was so primitive looking back, but it was Fortran, and it was punching holes in cards. So, you know, but you had to work out a puzzle. They'd go, okay, here's a bunch of data. You got to sort it for this purpose. And you have to keep the computer from getting into an endless loop so it spits miles of paper out on the floor. Go. And so suddenly when I was working on Tron, it was like, oh, this is kind of the merging of that too. And so at least I knew enough to understand what those guys who were just genius specialists in it, at least knew to know what they were up against, and have the patience to, you know, to sit through it and maybe have a nudge or two that would help. And so and another thing that was Richard Taylor, who was just a brilliant supervisor on it from the computer side, he coined this phrase that we were working on state-of-the-art dinosaurs. Because the production lasted for long enough that a number of updates had happened in various areas, and we could not adopt them because it would disrupt our production flow. So we had to...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure the hardware platforms had to be updated. At that point in time, they were updated every 6 months.
Yeah, so we had to stay with the older stuff, but we were doing cutting-edge breakthroughs on the older stuff. So I thought his phrase... state-of-the-art dinosaurs was pretty good when you talked about the equipment we were working on.
That is good. And I really do mean it when I say you were reshaping motion pictures in the way that we see today with some of the technologies out there. It really is.
And you know what? I was so happy to see some of my friends who were worried about computers later on really embrace them. Some right away. I mean, before we were done, you know, John Lasseter was popping into our trailer and looking at our screens going, that stuff looks pretty cool, you know. So
yeah,
he was into it right away. And then, you know, Brad Bird really embraced it, got into it. And then, you know, artist by artist, they really understood that it wasn't the enemy. But it's funny, people would still go, but there's a line in the sand. It will never do character animation. It'll only do things like effects. And then like, well, no, it'll... In the hands of good character animators, it will do that too. So we're in a really interesting zone now where it's just kind of stories exist. And I kind of think the designation of media is becoming more and more irrelevant. I kind of wish they didn't have an animation category. I told Don Hahn, who produced Beauty and the Beast back in the day, that that whole category was created out of fear when they were nominated for Best Picture. And this is like, holy cow, animated film might win Best Picture. We got to put it in another category.
Right.
That's interesting.
But, you know, it's like the nine old men and, you know, everybody that worked with Walt, they saw it as filmmaking. They didn't see it as something different. And they would say, you know, I never made a kid's movie in my life. I just made films that I was interested in. And maybe I was appealing to the kid in me as an adult, but I never focus tested, never tried to target an audience except ourselves. And they said, you know what, if when you're making the movie, if you don't love it, you don't have proof that anybody loves it. But if you love it, you know somebody does. So
it's very true. That's very true. I mean, I think as Disney nerds and me and Sam and Ed and, you know, I know for me, when a new Disney movie comes out, I'm probably just as much or probably more excited than my kids.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's we just, you know, putting the films together, want it to reach as many people as possible. And so, you know, I always worked with people who had that mindset that we're not making it for a particular audience. We're making it for ourselves and hopefully for the broadest age group out there. Hopefully, if you do it well, kids and teenagers and young adults and middle aged and senior citizens will all find something that's emotionally gripping about it, and love to be along for the ride. I mean, that's the goal.
That is the goal. Absolutely, engage.
Yeah.
So Jerry, you mentioned the nine old men.
Yeah.
I was doing some research on some of the things that you've done, and I came across some home movies with Ward Kimball.
Oh, yeah. There's this.
They were incredible. Can you tell me a little bit about how that happened?
There's quite a few more, although they're on wiggly old VHS tape that's kind of ghosted. I'm going to try to post a few more things that aren't too destroyed by the ancient VHS wiggle, that curses things over time. But yeah, that was Ward and his family would do a day where they would get all the trains going, and so
it reminded me of the series I Love Toy Trains that he did, because mm-hmm. my children were into that for a while, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is incredible.
Yeah, and I have footage not only in his train shop where he had all the miniatures, which were just amazing. I mean, it was such an extensive layout, but also out in the yard where he had the big trains going, and so he'd get the steam going, and there's this one section where I just love it. He came over and he looks, he has this twinkle in his eye, and he's like, yeah, this next thing, the steam shoots out about 100 feet, you know. He's like, he's getting ready for it, and then he goes and stands over, okay boys, let it go, and I boosh, this huge jet goes out there, and he just sort of looks at me like, isn't this cool?
It's like, that's awesome.
It's like a monster, you know. But he'd love to surprise people and to give them a good time. And so I just, Rebecca and I had the good fortune of going out there with Chuck Richardson and Brian McEntee and Kelly Kimball. You know, Kelly Kimball had done costume design for me on Back to Neverland. So, you know, she had done the little lost boy suit for Robin and stuff. So they just went, hey, you know, Ward's having this train day. Come on over. And I took my behemoth video camera at the time. You know, it was the thing where you needed the separate recorder deck that hung like a big purse.
Right.
And then you had the camera, too. And so I took a bunch of video. And at the end of the day, he wanted to see it. He's like, yeah, put on that video. You know, I want to see what you've been shooting. And so he and his wife and family and, you know, a bunch of them had gathered around, and he really got a kick out of it. And he said, you know what? He said, this is better than, he said, ABC came over and they, or maybe it's NBC, but he said one of the big networks had come over to interview him, and they brought a crew and they tried to set up moments and everything. And he said, this is better than any of that stuff, because I would just sort of try to be a fly on the wall and just kind of get candid moments. And so there's a lot more that I'd like to post. And like I said, some of it has sort of the ghost wiggle stuff that's, maybe I should just put it up even with that in the way and people would like it. But
yeah, I'd watch it. I was going to ask where you're putting that for our listeners.
I had put it, actually, the one piece that's available other than YouTube, you can also find on my website. On the homepage, you'll see Tim Burton's face all the way to the right. And when you click it, it takes you to Scraps from the Basement. And so you see Ward is one of those things that you see. So it's a video of...
So Tim Burton is the key to the basement.
Yes. And so there's two films with Tim. We did Doctor Doom and Luau together. And so anyway, that's right now where Ward is hiding, is in the basement of my website.
Got it. So I know we're approaching an hour here, and I'm respectful of time, mm-hmm. but I did want to ask a little bit about the most recent thing you were working on, the Marvel Experience.
Right.
Which is a traveling show here, which is, by the way, for our listeners, it's going to be going through Philadelphia and St. Louis and New York and Chicago here in June into the summer months. So tell me a little bit about that.
Right. Well, that was really a fun experiment where, you know, it's a brave idea of kind of taking some of the immersion that you expect from a theme park and taking that on the road. And so there's multiple domes. I was working in 80-foot domes projecting in. Sometimes I was projecting in like 170-degree swath across the dome. Other times I had 80-foot 360-degree 3D stereoscopic dome. So wow. Everywhere you look, all the way around you and over top of you, the image exists. And so that was a really fun challenge. As I was working with the wonderful people at Rhythm and Hues, there's some key people that were remaining after the downsizing, after you know, they'd gone through the bankruptcy and stuff. There were still some people left, and they'd kind of been rescued by this group from India called Prana. And so I was working with Rhythm and Hues and with Prana. And so we would work a long day here in LA, and then we'd hook up for a video conference at night, which was the beginning of their day in India, and we'd continue until 11:30 at night with them. And so at the beginning, when we were trying to get our hands on production for a segment like that in the Dome, you know, that they're trying to get a handle on it and saying, okay, which shots are these characters in? And you go, well, there's only one shot. It's like, what? What do you mean? Well, the entire experience, you are in the world. So the sky goes all the way over you and the horizon continues all the way around you and you move through this world. So there's no close up, reverse, cut to the down shot, up shot. You are just continuously moving through the world. So it's all one shot. And every character is in that one shot. They're like, oh my gosh, how are we gonna put that on a production schedule? So it was a real handful, and I worked with also a wonderful team doing previs. They're called the Third Floor, and they're on Wilshire Boulevard here in LA. And they did previs for Gravity and Maleficent and the new Godzilla and on and on. They helped visualize how things are going to go before you get into the final most expensive animation. And so they helped put together a virtual camera where we weren't entirely immersed, but at least I could bring the animators in and we could take turns looking around with a screen that was a little bigger than an iPad screen, but everywhere we looked, the world existed. And so you could figure out some more specifics about, let's put that character up higher, let's move this one further over. But of course, being fully immersed is a very dynamic experience. And I crossed my fingers. We did a lot of hard work and guessing. And I got to see how it all fit into that 360 theater two nights before the audience did.
Oh, wow.
and it worked, thank goodness.
Thank goodness, two nights before the audience. There's no going
back
at this
point.
Yeah, I mean,
and that was one of the things that on occasion I've done that where I've you realize that the challenges of technology and production schedule sometimes make choices like jumping on the back of a bull. And I kind of felt that way going in, like, I love this content, but I'm jumping on the back of a bull. We all are. And so that was one of the, you know, just one of the consequences was some things I was able to, had to guess at, other things I was able to test. But then, you know, a really cool aspect is over several cities, we then were able to tweak and refine. And I talked to a group of people. It turned out later they were, I guess, a number of people from Yelp reviewers. And they had come sought me out. Somebody had mentioned that I directed all the media for it. And so I was explaining about how in their city we had changed, tweaked some things to accommodate a better experience. And anyway, they got very intrigued with the idea that this wasn't just a push a button and it plays finished thing, that in a way it was an app that was being updated, that was, it was like a big part of a theme park floating around the country, and it was getting updates. So it was more of a living thing. So that they kind of were able to relate that to the mobile devices they were holding in their hand. It's like, yeah, this gets updates, and this giant 80-foot screen gets updates. And so it's evolving. And when I come see it four cities from now, there might be some really cool things added in. And so anyway, it was a real challenge. I got to meet with Joe Quesada out in New York, who's a wonderful creative leader of Marvel. They were very hands-on. We did a lot of incremental presentations to them on the material, and so it was great to have their blessing. And just another awesome thing is I got to work at Giant Studios for some mocap stuff, and was able to use the same motion capture performance team that James Cameron did for Avatar for a lot of his stuff when he was working with the people that were supportive to the main cast. And there's a main guy named Kevin Dorman over there who's just a wonderful performer. And so he, you know, he doesn't look at it as flailing around. I mean, he really thinks in terms of personality, and I'm getting into Iron Man's head now and sort of his playful arrogance that's charming. And now I'm getting into a whole different character. And so, you know, that also gave me the opportunity to be in the trenches with them as well. And they're super creative people. They've just changed their company name to Profile. They're on the up in Burbank now on the Warner's annex lot that's up Hollywood Way. And they're charging ahead with more capabilities now. But we were able to deal with some of those big challenging scenes by doing really careful performance capture in mocap and then do keyframing animation for facial performances. And so I really had animators and performers wearing the motion capture suits cooperating together to make moments come alive. And I
sounds incredible.
So yeah, I'm not a purist about that stuff. I know some people still are, but I really think, you know, I've met some people in animation and mocap and various other things who are not terrific performers, but I've met some who are. And so if you have people doing mocap who are good performers and you have people doing animation who are good performers, they really are on the same side. And so to merge efforts, I think makes a lot of sense sometimes. And so we got some really fun results that everybody was happy with, so that the mocap team was excited to see what the animators added to them. The animators were happy to get a solid performance foundation from the mocap people. And, we tried to keep it really cohesive. So it wasn't like you're handing it off to somebody. It's like you're trying to get all these different players in to participate in bringing, you know, single moments to life. And they all sort of plug into that moment together. And so it keeps it from getting diffuse, you know.
I think the whole concept's incredible as well. The whole traveling theme park attraction. We've heard about that for years, that Disney wanted to do something.
Right.
It sounds like the technology's finally there to allow that to happen.
Well, and it's getting better and better. And I think that it was just really brave of Hero Ventures to just take that first step and go, you know what? A lot of people sort of toe in the water and a lot of people that are doing brave experiments with pieces of it, but we're just going to jump in. And, so I wish them all good luck as it continues on, but in the similar way that with so many of the attractions I've done for Disney, there comes a day where you've lived and breathed it and you know, just helped nurture it come to life, and you've made family connections with all these great people, and then there's the day where it now lives with the audience members and the guests, and you have to move, like, wish it well and move on to the next involving story and the next team. And so I'm not involved with it anymore, but I'm going to be monitoring its progress, and I wish them all the best.
Sure, absolutely. I do have a couple more things here.
Sure.
Some of them will have to wait for next time, but Jimmy, you have anything? I've been asking a lot of questions.
Yeah, I just have one quick question, Jerry. Out of all the things you've done in the theme parks, is there anything, because I have a favorite, but I'll let you answer first. Anything like that really stands out as, you know what, that was like, this is clearly my favorite? Or I know they're probably all like children to you, that, you know, you've developed these things and worked hard, so it may be hard to pick, but anything stand out as your favorite?
Yeah, you know, it's the like you say, I mean, you're right, there's things that you find charming and engaging about different ones for different reasons, and reasons why you were excited about them, that sort of for different parts of you. And, you know, everything from the animation magic where people draw and in their own drawings they've done freehand come alive and are involved with the show a few minutes later. You know, it's fun to see people empowered by watching their own work actually come alive. And it was just so wonderful to work way back with Robin and with Steve Martin. But I hate to pick one, but if I had to just quickly pick one, which you're forcing me to do, I I think Cinemagique, it played in Paris, is still playing in Paris, with Julie Delpy and Martin Short and Cheki Cario and Alan Cumming.
Nice.
There was just something that was especially heartfelt about the team, the message. I mean, the rest of the park is about, you know, how movies are made. And the Cinemagique Pavilion is, why are we in love with movies? Why do we go see them? And so it was really a Valentine to a century of cinema, and had its own romantic story that overlaid all these iconic moments and had its own value, in which, you know, Marty was in love with Julie, and you know, they sort of move heaven and earth to be together, and Alan Cumming as the wizard sort of takes pity on them and helps out a little bit. There's just a sweetness to that. And I, you know, all this, these years later, ran into a producer, Chrissy, and we just immediately hugged. I mean, it was like, it was the spirit of the whole project. It was just made you think about you know, warmth and storytelling and character connection and celebrating humanity. And so it's like anytime we see each other, people that have worked on it, it's just our first impulse is just a hug. And I think from what I can gather from people who have seen it, I think it evokes that same kind of warmth from them as well. And, you know, I try to get it in all my things, but as far as the parks, I think that's it. And then outside of the parks, I would say the Brave Little Toaster just is, I've had so many people who are now in their 20s get in touch and share thoughts and memories and feelings about that, and in ways that I never expected when we were making it, and it's just wonderful. So, you know, both of those things have a warmth and humanity about them that that I'm just was pleased to be part of, and glad to see those ripples going out in the audience.
That's fantastic.
That is great. And I tell you what, next time we chat, I want to talk about, there's so many
other
things.
I'd love to be able to dig into some of these, just a little, you know, more
sure.
in-depth conversations about all of these things. But I will tell you my favorite. And it has not, I mean, some of these are definitely more nostalgic than others, but I'm a huge fan, as short-lived as it was, of Alien Encounter.
Yes, the scary version.
Oh my God, man! How that thing,
terrestrial,
so fantastic. Oh my God, it's like one of the best attractions I think Disney's ever gotten rid of.
Well, you know what? We had a blast doing that, and I at first I had come on just to do the you know, the media, and then Eisner and Marty Sklar went and reviewed it in the park, and they called me and Rick Rothschild back and said, you know, keep living with the rest of it too. It's like that stuff you did with the media, keep doing that with the rest of it. And so Rick and I and Bran Farron, who's a genius, came in and was working with amazing sound technology. And so anyway, you know, we could get into a lot of fun stories about that, but having fun, like scaring people, but in the most good-natured way, hopefully. But we had people tell us that it was one of the scariest things they'd ever been through. And but you know, everybody I cast was had comedic chops.
Sure.
You know, but it was funny. It's like a bunch of comics scaring the crap out of you.
I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was truly a great, and I, you know, I didn't get to experience that many times, but I thought it was a truly great, like, pulls you in. I thought it was fantastic.
So a little piece of trivia, you know, the hapless worker in there that gets eaten by the alien.
Yes.
He was the voice of Plugsy in The Brave Little Toaster.
Okay.
When the big lamp comes out and he goes, hey, please, you know, feel free to enter, all of yous. Like the big throated character, actually, yeah. It was the same actor. I went, hey, I need you to play this guy that gets eaten.
He's
like, I'm in.
Sounds good.
Deep. That's good. So we can dig into that next time. I mean, directing George Lucas and Michael Eisner, Aerosmith, Martin Short, No Canada. Dinosaur, I have tons of things to talk about. But outside of that, we talked about the last thing you finished. What's Jerry working on now?
Top secret. Actually, it's super fun. I feel so blessed. I'm now starting at the beginning phase, about a two-year period, where I'm at Imagineering R&D. So I'm an executive R&D Imagineer. And so that's really wonderful. It's just, you know, it's the kind of inner sanctum where magic is encouraged to bloom in a million different ways. And so it's just a treat after so many years of taking on specific stories and finding the way to bring magic alive in that specific story, to now be charged with just sort of like stirring the magic pot.
Nice.
And it's like, you know, what kind of magic could we discover that might be used in a myriad of stories? And so it's really sort of like, I feel like I'm getting to be the Sorcerer's Apprentice. I hope I don't screw things up like Mickey did, but it's just fun to, you feel like you're getting the magic hat and the cauldron, and you're just getting to go.
Well, they took the hat away from studios. They gave it to you. That's what happened.
That's one of the secrets.
It's in your backyard. Right. All right.
There. Run, Sam, Jimmy, run for it. They're coming for you. So anyway, it's a treat. And, you know, like with most of that stuff, they that stuff is sort of deep confidential until they choose to unveil it in whatever way they deem, either in the parks in an adventure or in some other way. But that's where I am right now and having a grand time.
That's fantastic. It's almost like full circle.
Yeah. It's funny. There were, I was chatting with some people there and they were sort of doing a, who's been here the longest? Who's been at Disney the longest sort of thing. And somebody's like,
oh, yeah.
They said, oh, well, she's got y'all beat 20 years. And I said,
no.
So I'm back in the room. I'm like 43. And they're like, what?
There's no way. Wait a minute. What?
You've been alive 43 years? And I went, no, at Disney. I was a high school student, but still.
Still got, right.
I was a high school student animating, and yeah.
And you know what is other really crazy is I dug out a letter. The envelope is all ripped to shreds, but thankfully the letter inside was pristine. It was from 1971, and I had written to Imagineering to WED, as it was called in those days. And, sure. You know, I'd let them know, you know, dear sirs, to whom it may concern, that I was really interested in building an audio animatronic figure, but I really needed to know what kind of skin material they used in the Pirates of the Caribbean, for example. And they wrote back a letter, and it's signed by Robert White Design Department. And they like typed a specific letter to me. They cautioned me to be careful because it was a hot melt and I should have adults around. And they sent me a whole article just on the material Duraflex. It's like, you know, pages and pages. And, you know, it's signed with a ballpoint pen on a hand type letter. And that kind of stuff.
It doesn't
just,
happen
it really matters, you know, and I just am so amazed that that after they were encouraging, here I am back in it. So, you know, I try to pass it on and be encouraging to other people because, you know, they definitely can do it.
Yep. I don't think stuff like that happens too much anymore. That's very, very cool.
It is very cool. And when I had the storyboard team working on Cranium Command in the animation building in Florida, we had Kirk Wise, Gary Trousdale were there storyboarding. Their next gig was directing Beauty and the Beast. But, you know, they were on display and audiences going past and seeing them do sketches and stuff. And either when I was there or when I was off at the stunt show and they were working there alone, and Rebecca was there, Daryl Rooney was there, there would invariably be this moment several times a week where the tour would continue past, and when the people would move away, there'd be one kid just face plastered against the glass looking just awe-inspired, and they wouldn't leave. And then you'd see parents wandering back and trying to encourage them away from the glass. And so, you know, we would always go, you know, okay, who's gonna go talk to the kid? and one of us would go out in the hall, and we tried to really do two things. One is like really talk to the kid first and see why they were interested and what their dreams were. And invariably it had something to do with, I want to be an artist, or I want to make films, or I want to work at Disney or something. And so the first thing we'd do is let the kid know, keep doing it, you can do it. I was a kid with dreams too, you can do it. And then the second thing is we'd look at the parents and make sure they understood, I'm not being patronizing to your kid. I'm being honest, your kid can do this. So support them, you know?
Yep.
So, you know, we really tried to be proactive about it back in the day. And, you know, occasionally we meet people who say, hey, I came and saw the film and that's how I get started in the business. And, you know, so occasionally it had a specific effect like that. But even if it was just generally encouraging kids to have dreams and pursue them, you know, it's all good. And I look back and, man, they did it for me. They were very encouraging.
That's great. It really is.
It's incredible. And Jerry, we appreciate your time. That's an awesome story to end on, and something for our listeners too, because I'm sure they're out there. Oh, I want to do that.
Right.
Go for it, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's been a pleasure being on the Disney Nerds podcast.
Thank you. And we will, you know, your website's the place to find out what that secret stuff is before it comes out. And Tim Burton is the key to the basement.
Actually, no, none of the secret stuff will appear there.
Damn.
Damn. At all. The day that it does. Right.
But it's
does,
still, Tim Burton is still the key to the basement.
That's true.
I'll remember.
Yes, the day that secret stuff appears is the day I disappear and my website disappears.
Right.
Oh,
so
okay.
So that won't happen.
Got it.
Right.
Thank you so much.
All righty.
Really hey guys,
appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you guys for listening to the Disney Nerds. Jerry, thank you for being our guest. And remember, you can get me, Sam, at the Disney Nerds, and Jimmy is at Jimmy at the Disney Nerds. Thank you so much. Kongaloosh.
Quaharini.